I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and after all is said and done, it may be all over today. The Senate is expected to vote today on President Obama's economic stimulus package. If passed, it will have to be reconciled with the House bill passed last week. Senate Republicans added new tax relief for homebuyers to their bill, adding to the bill's other tax breaks for new car buyers. And a bipartisan group of senators is working on an amendment to remove tens of billions in spending provisions that have been heavily criticized. Well, Gail Chadwick is congressional correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, and she joins us from Capitol Hill. Gail, what's the mood there? We know that President Obama invited three key Senate leaders to the White House yesterday to talk about this bill. So what's happening today?
High anticipation. There's a lot of wait for what will come out, especially out of the deal being worked out between Senator Ben Nelson of Nebraska and Susan Collins of Maine, moderates who have worked together in the past on a lot of dicey issues in the Senate. And what I'm hearing is that when this comes through, it promises anywhere from $30 to $50 billion of cuts in spending in the stimulus plan. When that comes through, the vote will come very quickly and it will pass.
And what are some of the cuts anticipated?
Well, we've gotten rid of the unfortunate $200 million to resod the National Mall, so they're now focusing on things you've already heard about, you know, new polar icebreakers. Will that really create jobs? $198 million for Filipino veterans, long promised back in World War II days. $60 million or so for State Department diplomatic programs. That doesn't sound essential to people. I think the arts, about $50 million for the arts on the way out, $15 billion for college scholarships is being discussed, $150 million for honeybee insurance.
Well, you know, and I'm just going to stop you there and say a lot of these have been, you know, excoriated. But, you know, honeybees are a real problem, you know. We know they're endangered, and, you know, helping kids go to college does seem like it's an investment in the future.
No, all of this, and this is a point that Republicans and Democrats are making, all of these programs, no one is saying they're not important or good. The point is, do they fit in a stimulus bill? Is it worth borrowing money at this critical point? Will it actually create jobs and help the economy? You know, the kind of case that is hovering like a bad ghost over all of these deliberations this week is the Japanese case. They tried to spend their way out of a deep slump and only ended up spending a lot of money and losing a decade. So that phrase, Japan's lost decade, unless we do this right, is something that's being discussed a lot.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned that some of these people that are emerging are not people we think of as leaders on the Republican side. What do you make of that?
They're in the middle. You know, we are now looking not for 80% vote. That's clear the Republicans are not going to go along with that. So the president has really been focused on Republicans he thinks can be turned. That means the two senators from Maine, Collins and Snow, both of whom voted for their piece of the bill in respectively the Finance Committee and the Appropriations Committee. So there is some support for it already. They don't think they're going to get Republican conservatives who have been emboldened this week by polls that suggest that the public is getting more dubious about this plan. They don't like hearing about however important the honeybees are. It just doesn't sound like it's worth spending $1 trillion for.
Right. Well, as we said, a final vote is expected tonight, but then this bill has to be reconciled with the House one passed last week. How quickly do you anticipate we might move from here?
I think once the Senate vote comes, it'll go very quickly. They're already pre-cooking what the conference would look like between the House and Senate versions of this bill. And leaders in both the House and Senate are very committed to having something to the president's desk by President's Day weekend, next weekend. They're saying if this bill isn't done by the recess, there will be no recess.
And what is your sense just at the end of this week, Gail Chadwick, of how President Obama is faring? We saw the withdrawal of former Senator Tom Daschle's bid for a cabinet position. President Obama saying that he screwed up, messed up, different, you know, several choices of words to explain it.
Yeah.
Has that cost the president in this push for the bill?
Well, we'll see, of course. But my sense is that any time the president loses control of the subject in the middle of something this important, it's very bad, especially someone that came in with the level of expectation, popularity, and frankly, eloquence that this president has. He should have been able to keep Congress focused like a laser on this issue, and having to waste a couple of days dealing with late-night television jokes about Democrats not paying taxes, this hurt.
Yeah.
But I think he responded to it gracefully, not stonewalling, taking the blame for it. That is, politics 101 for not being bogged down in a mistake.
Gail Chadwick, Christian Science Monitor, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Well, the California woman who gave birth to octuplets made headlines 2 weeks ago, but as more information trickles out about her family life, that she's single, unemployed, living with her parents, and has six other children also through in vitro fertilization, well, the birth has quietly left the front pages, but it's still being hotly discussed in the fertility world. Several days after the birth, her mother, the woman's mother, said she's gone too far. Who helped her go that far? And what systems are in place to prevent a mother from going too far? For herself, for her children, for society. The costs of the delivery and neonatal intensive care the babies continue to receive are astronomical. About $200,000 for the delivery, $1.3 million for the hospital care. If they go home within a month, they stay longer, costs will rise. There are a lot of questions, and we want to ask some of them today with George Annis, Chair of Health, Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University School of Public Health. Professor, welcome.
Thank you.
And we also invite in Dr. Michael Alper. He's Medical Director and CEO of Boston IVF, one of the country's most successful fertility centers. And, Doctor, I want to start with you. In vitro, doctors combine eggs and sperm in a lab and then grow the embryo and implant it in the uterus. This is very different from artificial insemination.
Right. IVF, as you may know, has been around for about 25 years and involves placing sperm and egg together to create embryos and introduce the embryos into the womb. So it's quite different than IUI. Intrauterine insemination is the placement of sperm directly into the uterus. It's a non-surgical procedure, quite different from in vitro fertilization, where sperm and eggs are mixed together to create embryos.
Well, let's stay with in vitro then, because that's the case of the story we're speaking of. Are there rules, laws, guidelines, that tell a doctor like yourself how many you can implant?
There certainly are. And in fact, this case that's created so much media attention is really in vitro fertilization gone wild. This is an aberration. And us in the community, in the medical community, when we see the media attention given to this sort of aberration, it really deflects from some of the other core issues that face our field.
Well, let me just begin to say that we don't yet know where these embryos were created. We don't yet know the clinic. We don't yet know anything about how these embryos were implanted in this woman. But you say there are guidelines. What are they?
Yeah, in fact, the American Society of Reproductive Medicine, which is our national professional body, issued guidelines around 1998 to 1999 governing the number of embryos that are considered reasonable to reintroduce into a woman. And these were further redefined and actually become much stricter just recently, last year. And in fact, in somebody young, we would almost never replace more than one or two embryos.
But that's you. George Annis, your thoughts on this. Should there be laws? Guidelines are one thing, but obviously somebody, doesn't have to obey the guidelines.
No, they don't. There are guidelines, and they're relatively recent in terms of one or two embryos. I was on the Ethics Committee of the American Society of Reproductive Medicine for about 6 years, and we spent a lot of time on this issue and actually many, many other issues. And certainly the society is very happy with guidelines. They don't want laws, and I can understand that, and you don't want to get the government involved in human reproduction. On the other hand, I've come to believe that we do need more regulation than we have, and something like a private public organization like UNOS, the United Network for Organ Sharing that we have with organ transplantation, seems to me to be the model that we should be looking at.
What's to keep a woman from shopping around till she finds a clinic that she can convince to implant eight embryos that doesn't ask if she has six other children?
Well, I doubt she. No, anybody could find a clinic. I guess one person could, but
did.
It's just almost beyond belief that anyone would purposely implant eight embryos.
Well, then I guess I have to ask Dr. Alpert a question then. Dr. Alpert, is there any other way to have eight births if you don't implant eight embryos?
An embryo can obviously divide in two or three to create multiples, but that's highly unlikely. you know, without knowing the specifics of this case, it's very hard mm-hmm. to comment, but assume that a large number of embryos were replaced in a young woman. That's really not considered the standard of care in our community today.
Well, and have you, Dr. Alper, had to turn women away?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I think it's obviously it's a discussion between a doctor and a patient, but at the end of the day, if I feel I'm doing something that potentially will harm somebody as a physician, it's something that I can't be involved in.
Well, but here's where it gets even stickier for you, Georganis. You seem to have an overarching thought about in vitro procedures that I think, let me see if I've got it right, that there's a disconnect between the goal of getting a woman pregnant and the thoughts of a future of the child that might come of that.
Well, I think there certainly can be. I mean, the goal that almost everybody has in IVF is one healthy baby. But, you know, historically, when people, unlike in Massachusetts, which we do have insurance coverage for, but historically when people had to pay for every cycle out of pocket, they wanted every possibility to have a baby. And it certainly used to be true that the more embryos you implanted, the more likely it was that you'd have one pregnancy. Obviously, you ran a risk of twins and triplets. And over the years, the problem with multiple births has overtaken, I think, the chance that you won't have any. And the disconnect is that infertility doctors, their patient is the couple, usually the infertile couple that wants to have a baby. The baby's in the neonatal intensive care unit when they're triplets or more for a month, 2 months, 3 months, and it's a different doctor in charge. And there is that disconnect between taking care of the woman and the couple and the babies.
And what do you think that leads to?
It has led in the past. It continues to lead to up to multiple births. And everyone now sees, I think, multiple births as a big problem. It should be avoided, which is why we're trying to limit the number of embryos that are implanted to one or maybe two, you know, at least in women under 35, and I'd argue in women under 40.
Well, hold on 1 second, because when you say everyone agrees, I've been listening to talk radio, and boy, some of the parents of these triplets who waited their whole lives, you know, for this blessed moment, they're not that upset. And Dr. Alper, what do you think of that characterization of people like yourself who are concentrating so hard on a success for the parents and having a disconnect from what actually happens to the children?
Robin, what you say is true. There is a disconnect because when somebody's tried for many, many years to have a family, they cannot imagine going from zero to twins or triplets, God forbid. So there is a big disconnect there. And also there's an opportunity for education here because studies have shown that infertile couples actually, in the majority of cases, prefer twins because they don't understand the morbidity and risks associated with multiple pregnancies. So we have to educate couples that the goal of IVF is one healthy baby, one baby at a time.
I just want to underscore, Dr. Alper said, God forbid there might be triplets, but again, that's because it increases the risk for all three infants. Michael Alper is medical director of Boston IVF. We've also been speaking with bioethicist Georganis. When we come back, more on those risks. And some countries have laws restricting IVF treatments, should the U.S. Also, later today, Shepard Fairey, the street artist behind that iconic Obama campaign poster. Back in a minute, here and now. Welcome back. We're talking about the ethics of in vitro fertility treatments in light of the recent birth of octuplets with Georganis, a bioethicist at Boston University, and Michael Alper, medical director of the Boston IVF Fertility Center. And Dr. Alper, what are the risks of multiple births?
The risks for prematurity are quite significant. Small birth weight, trouble breathing, and many other complications.
Georganis?
No, that's right. And even long-term disabilities, too. I mean, you really don't want to have multiples if you can avoid it.
But how far do you go? Do you think it should be legislated, a law against multiple births in vitro clinics?
You could have a law, which I don't think you should have. Some European countries have it. Actually, have a law that limit the number of embryos you can implant, usually to one.
Huh.
I really prefer, as I said before, some public-private oversight. But I wouldn't go as far as to make it a crime to have more than one baby.
Right.
Or not to reduce high order multiples. Although I think no woman should be a candidate for IVF who doesn't understand the risks of multiples and doesn't agree, at least in principle, if they're more than two or three, for sure, to reduce them.
But you come face to face with these parents. How would they react to, you know, gee, I'm going to encourage you to put just one or just two when they think four is better?
Well, there is an education component of this, and I think when they really understand what it means to have a handicapped child, when somebody has triplets or quadruplets, it will bring home the risks that are associated with it. It's not what is often portrayed in the media as, you know, a big happy family with many children. It's the situation is often quite reverse, and I think discussion between the doctor and the patient is really what this should all focus on.
Well, I'm sure we're going to hear from large families through IVF who say it's been a great experience for them. But your point is that sometimes it isn't. And I'm thinking, if parents make the decision not to implant multiple embryos, then they may not have to make what we hear is an often excruciating choice to selectively reduce them. In other words, to abort some of them during the pregnancy if problems arise.
Right. A very tough decision. And as part of the counseling, it's better to understand that before the IVF procedure begins. Anytime we put more than one embryo back, that's part of the discussion.
Right. Georgianis, you're nodding.
Well, it definitely should be part of the discussion. But, you know, obviously reductions are damage control, and you'd like to prevent the situation where reduction is indicated by limiting it to one or maybe two embryos. But even when you do two, one can split.
You have to weigh the number of embryos versus the chance of pregnancy overall.
Mm-hmm.
And in some populations, if you put one embryo back, the chance of pregnancy at all is so dismal that the patient's going through a lot of treatment and risk for very low yield.
I agree with that, and that's why it's hard to have a law that says, you know, for everybody, we treat everybody the same and everybody just gets one embryo.
Right. I want to ask you one other thing. You know, there's been hints that Nadia Suleiman, this young 33-year-old mother, again, with six children already under seven, that she may not be in her right mind. Who determines that? How do you determine before these procedures, doctor, that somebody is psychologically ready?
Well, I had a case like that fairly recently where an individual came to see me with six children and wanted a seventh. And it was the first time in 25 years of practice that I've seen this, and it just struck me as odd. But we have a process. Obviously, we discuss it with the patient, try to get a sense of where they are mentally. There's social workers and psychologists that are part of our team at Boston IVF. And also, we have ethics committee meetings. In addition to that, we have monthly meetings where we have all the physicians get together. And at the end of the day, when you get input from psychologists and social workers and, in some cases, ethicists, you make the right decision.
Professor Hannes, there may be something else going on here as well. Ms. Suleiman is the daughter of an Iraqi. She and her family are poor. I'm thinking of the McCoy septuplets. This was in 1997. They got a 16-room house, a 15-passenger van, baby food from Gerber, a lifetime supply of Pampers from Procter & Gamble. Is there something about how she doesn't fit our image of a nuclear family and maybe she's going to be, you know, become a burden to society, which, you know, something about her being a single woman.
There does seem to be an undercurrent of that, although more recently it looks like, you know, she's going to do fine, that she's got an agent, she's going to be able to sell her story, she's going to be able to make multiple millions of dollars.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, the latest, you know, people are backing off, you know, people are,
really?
You know, nobody wants to, because it's curdled so, and I'm just wondering if...
Well, it's not a feel-good story it was at the beginning with the team of 47 doctors delivering eight babies that look like they might do okay. Yeah, that does seem to be part of it. That's disturbing. I mean, I don't think class should weigh into how we feel about a woman having babies. On the other hand, to take up Michael's point, when a woman comes to you with having six children and wants infertility treatment, I think you really have to ask the question. You know, most Americans would say, you are not infertile.
Dr. Alpin, how much is the cost? Now, that shouldn't be, you know, the primary consideration. We're talking about a blessing, a life, but what is the cost?
In vitro fertilization is expensive. It runs, I'm going to guess, around $8,000 to go through a cycle, plus medication. Fortunately, there are about 11 states in the country that have some sort of mandated insurance coverage for couples so that they can have a family.
This is making people very angry, you know, that they feel that down the road they may, you know, as a society, be paying for these 14 kids, children of a mom with no work. George, you're nodding on that.
Well, yeah, it does get to people. I mean, remember the Clinton health plan. We're about to debate national health insurance again. But when we did the Clinton plan back in 1993, you may recall that IVF was the only thing that wasn't included, IVF and plastic surgery, because it was felt to be elective and certainly is not life-saving. And that it was a personal choice, but if you made the personal choice, you should pay for it. 15 years later, we do have 11 states, as Michael has said, that mandate insurance, but that's still controversial.
Hmm. Well, just to make a quick comment, you know, I don't regard fertility treatment as elective. For those of your those members of your audience who have children, I'd like them to imagine their lives without their kids. The drive to reproduce is so strong that this is not an elective type of thing. And that's my personal view of, you know, in 25 years in the field and just witnessing what couples go through to try to have a family.
And Professor Hannes, it sounds like you still have questions about the whole field.
Well, yeah, I think that, you know, this is an aberrational case, but it's only aberrational cases and tragedies and catastrophes in any field that make us sit back and say, well, gee, do we need more oversight? Do we need more regulation? And I think this is an opportunity to discuss that again.
George Hannes, Chair of Health Law, Bioethics, and Human Rights at Boston University's School of Public Health. We were also speaking with Dr. Michael Alper. He's Medical Director and CEO of Boston IVF, one of the country's most successful fertility centers. Dr. Alper, Professor Hannes, thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Back after the news. Here. Yesterday, Taliban insurgents in Afghanistan torched 10 trucks along NATO's supply route between Afghanistan and Pakistan. The day before, militants blew up a key NATO supply bridge connecting the two countries. President Obama has said the U.S. will shift its strategy in Afghanistan to focus more on fighting insurgents than on reconstruction, and he plans to deploy up to 30,000 additional troops there. Well, we're sure our next guest is going to have some thoughts on all of this. Rangeena Hamidi is a 32-year-old Afghan who grew up here in the States after her family fled Afghanistan when she was just a child, and she returned to her native Kandahar in 2003. She joins us in the studio. And Rangeena, first of all, when you returned to Afghanistan, what did you know about the country?
I went back with the memory of the beautiful stories that my parents told me of a land that was so not only beautiful in the physical sense, but also in the emotional sense of the family life, the village life, the closeness of a community that they were a part of. So I took that dream with me, and in the hopes of not necessarily expecting that at the time that I went back, because I know 30 years of war had completely destroyed it. But the vision and the mission of my work of returning back is to revive that beautiful dream that I grew up with.
You have founded Kandahar Treasures. This is a company that helps Afghan women sell their embroidered goods. So how is this kind of, you know, grassroots, trying to help women become entrepreneurs, how is that going?
It's going really well. I honestly, when I first went to Afghanistan, I was not expecting to start a business for women. But here's a group of people who don't have the blood, you know, the physical blood of other people on their hand. Here's a group of people that have suffered so much in the 30 years of war. I think women as an entire group is probably the biggest victim of the 30 years of war. And here is still yet a group that, in spite of all the troubles that they've gone through, they have no say in the making or remaking of their country. And so I just took that experience to translate it into giving economic empowering opportunities to women so that in the region, I have learned that when a woman has money, she has power to make a decision. The decision might start at home, a decision to keep her children, a decision to keep her daughters from marrying very young. And then hopefully, you know, as years go by, we women of Afghanistan will translate that power into making a better and a brighter and a peaceful tomorrow for our country.
Well, you speak so positively and glowingly, but we're hearing, you know, of young women who have acid thrown on their face because they're going to school. We hear there was some sunshine, but that's being tamped down for women.
I'm not trying to paint a bright picture to make the rest of the world look at our situation and think that there's no problems. Absolutely. I live in a region where every second of my life is at risk. I work on a daily basis knowing that the next minute can be my last minute. That's a fact of life that I live with on a daily basis. And it's not just me, it's every citizen of the country. But the reality is that if we focus on the gloom side only, the gloomy pictures, the gloomy stories, then it's very hard to get encouraged to keep moving forward. Yes, the young girls were brutally disfigured by the crazy men who threw acid on their faces. But let's look at the positive end of that story, where the young girls continue to fight to go to school. And they're calling on their other young sisters throughout the country to say, don't be discouraged from going to school because things as such happen. So I think it's the encouragement of the women on the ground that gives me the courage, and that should give courage to the world, that a positive future for Afghanistan is possible.
Obviously, though, you want more security. Do you see the Taliban?
You know, that's a question I would like to pose to the people of America, to the government of America. Who are the Taliban? I'm on the ground. Everybody talks about the Taliban in the press, in the newspaper, in the television and radios. We talk about the Taliban, but I like to know who the Taliban are. They're people who are obviously against the current regime and against the corruption and against the system that is going on in Afghanistan. And they're obviously acting very violently against it. But is that the Taliban? And then I hear here in Washington and in America, people talking about negotiating with the moderate Taliban. Well, what's a moderate Taliban? As an Afghan, I am confused as much as the Americans are confused about who this group called the Taliban are.
Are you saying it's more of a criminal element than an organized force?
I'm not saying one or the other. I think it could be both. I think criminals are taking advantage of the opportunity that when you put a blank statement on any activity to say that that's Taliban, criminals are taking advantage of that. But I would like to stress that the source of the Taliban from history and from the books and from the recent history of the region, we know where the source of the Taliban are. It's our neighboring country.
Pakistan.
Pakistan, exactly. Yeah.
How do you feel about what some see as America's unwillingness, at least till recently when we saw some strikes, to cut off that source of violence from Pakistan?
We're frustrated. Most Afghans are furious over the idea of why America is so blind to the reality of where this violence is really nourished and nurtured. And instead of coming and bombing villages and innocent people and killing civilians, as we've seen recently, and with 30,000 extra troops possibly coming, we know that there'll be an increase in the number of civilian deaths. Why not focus the energies on checking the border, where the Taliban or their insurgents or these remnants of violent people are crossing from? Once we control the border, I think America and the rest of the world will have a clear answer as to where these people are really trained and supported and resourced.
The New York Times recently reported that the Taliban in the South bring opium from Afghanistan into Pakistan and then guns back from Pakistan into Afghanistan. So there seems to be a lot of understanding of what you're saying. You met with staff from the offices of Senators Russ Feingold and Sheldon Whitehouse on this trip. What did they want to know from you? What did they ask you about Afghanistan?
They want to know the perspective of the people, the common people, the common citizens who are living the life in the midst of this war. The question was really posed about what our opinion was about the increase of the troops, the possibility 20,000 to 30,000 extra troops coming to Afghanistan. And I posed a question back saying, well, if the 20,000 extra troops are coming to bombard our villages and our homes and our people, when, you know, the reality is the villagers living in their homes at night, the Taliban come to their homes and at a gunpoint to their head saying, keep us and feed us. And then in the morning, when there's information to the U.S. military or to NATO forces, they may leave or they may be there, and then they get bombarded. And, of course, innocent people die in the midst. So for the people, it's a double-edged sword. No matter which way they turn to, they get hurt. And so if the purpose of the 20,000 troop is to just go and merely bomb out the Taliban or remnants of the Taliban, it is not going to be a solution to the problem.
Well, you say you want rule of law and justice. Does it matter to you which law is imposed? It could be Afghan law, Sharia law, fundamentalist Sharia law, or American law.
I will answer your question with a saying that is very popular in Afghanistan. People often say that they would rather have a law of the devil, but a law in the sense of implemented on the ground, the law of the devil, than having no law at all. Right now, Afghanistan is experiencing almost an anarchy where everybody, anybody can do anything that they want and get away with it because there is no form of law. Sharia law, from the extremist point of view, is obviously not the law that I'm calling for, but I don't think Sharia law necessarily means a violent or an unprogressive law system. Right now in our country, we have no implementation of law, any form of law whatsoever.
You're listening to Here and Now. Most Americans, you know, forgive us, we don't really know that much about Sharia law. It's new to a lot of Americans. But what we do know is that, for instance, it allows for stoning of women who are accused of being adulterers. And that's what people think when they think of Sharia law.
Right. And I think I pose the challenge to people to get educated.
Rangina Hamidi, I'm trying to do the math. You left Afghanistan during the Soviet invasion. How old were you?
3 and a half.
And then you went back after 2003.
Correct.
So you might be considered by Afghans an outsider, are you?
I was initially very much so. But after being there for 6 years and still showing my commitment with full heart and energy, I see the acceptance level rising. However, I think there will always be some level of a resentment among the population that I had the benefit to leave and get educated and get skilled and then come back. And now, you know, I can take advantage of a lot of opportunities that exist on the ground. And there's nothing I can do about it, honestly. I mean, it's not my fault one way or the other. But what keeps me motivating and what I use as my own self-defense mechanism is to tell the women and the men that I work with that if I had not left the country, I would be one of the very same people that I'm working with today. So I consider myself not only lucky but privileged to be able to help a community get a better life than they have today.
Rangina, are Afghans doing anything to fight the Taliban, or is it just too risky?
If we look at it from the lens of Americans, you would answer the question saying, no, Afghans are not doing anything about it because we're not seeing the marches, we're not seeing the letters, we're not seeing anything in an active form against the Taliban. But you have to understand that it is an extremely fearful society full of fear. Men and women are afraid of the regime changes. Should the Taliban come back to power tomorrow, they don't want to put their lives at risk so that they can become the first targets should the regime change. But we have to give credit to people on the ground in very small forms of action against it, subtle ways of voicing their opinion. And the best example is the very first historic peace prayer that the women organized in June of 2007, where the women gathered together in thousands and they prayed together, calling for peace. And I remember one woman getting up, a random woman that I don't know, and I probably can't find her if I looked for her. She got up to the mic and she said, if we kill a Talib or if we kill an American or if we kill a police officer of the Afghan army, we're killing a child who has a mother. And she cried and said, please listen to the heart of the mother. And I think that is the voice that needs to be heard more so than it is right now, because people in Afghanistan, especially the women of Afghanistan, are tired and they want peace and they want stability and they want this war to end. I mean, if we can give them credit for speaking against the Taliban, I think they're speaking against any kind of violent acts that happen on the ground.
Rangina Hamidi, founder of Kandahar Treasures. We'll link you at our website to theirs. It's a company that helps women in Afghanistan sell homemade goods. Rangina, thanks so much for coming in and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much for having me.
And let's get a quick update now on two stories we've been following. The Peanut Corporation of America, the company linked to that salmonella outbreak that's caused more than 550 illnesses and 8 deaths, says federal and state inspectors gave the plant the stamp of approval as recently as last year. And FDA officials told Congress yesterday that a loophole does exist where if a private company does its own testing, as is the case with the Georgia plant, negative results can be kept quiet. And now to the latest on that miraculous Hudson River landing last month. The Federal Aviation Administration released audio recordings of the back and forth between air traffic controllers and U.S. Airways Flight 1549 moments before the jet set down on the Hudson River. The first voice you'll hear is a controller at New York's LaGuardia Airport hoping to get the plane to land at Teterboro Airport in New Jersey. Listen to how calm everyone is.
Yeah, it was a bird strike. Can I get him in for runway one?
Runway one, that's good.
Cactus 1529, turn right 280, you can land runway 1 at Teterboro.
We can't do it.
Okay, which runway would you like at Teterboro?
We're going to be in the Hudson.
We're going to be in the Hudson. That's Chesley Sullenberger, the now famous pilot. All 155 people on board survived. This week, the National Transportation Safety Board confirmed that it was indeed a bird strike. Birds were in both the airline's engines. We'll be back in a minute with street artist Shepard Fairey, Here and Now. Welcome back. It's everywhere, on stickers, T-shirts, magazine covers. Street artist Shepard Fairey is the man behind the now iconic red, white, and blue hope image of Barack Obama, which spread virally during his presidential campaign. And now the Institute for Contemporary Art here in Boston is hosting an exhibit covering Fairey's 20-year career. As Here Now's Andrea Shea reports, even with a major museum show, Shepard Fairey is still dangling from billboards and rocking out.
If Shepard Fairey's career was a playlist, it would include tunes from the pioneers of punk and hip-hop, the Sex Pistols, Public Enemy, The Clash.
Joe Strummer from The Clash, the main lyricist for The Clash, is a very significant figure for Shepard Fairey.
Pedro Alonso curated the show, which opens tomorrow in Boston. He took about 50 journalists on a tour of Fairey's exhibition, which features bright red and cream-colored screen prints of Johnny Rotten, Chuck D, and Fairey's other musical influences.
The Clash allowed him at a very young age to understand that you could be cool and socially conscious at the same time.
Still representing that ethos right here. That timing was
yeah.
Not planned.
You're very timely with everything you do.
Wearing what else? A Clash T-shirt. Shepard Fairey arrived almost as if on cue. The photographers go nuts.
And then I'm working all the way up to large-scale canvases that I sell in galleries.
Fairey, no doubt, has a knack for timing. Consider his creation of the Barack Obama hope image. The artist says inspiration drove him to make it. Then Fairey distributed it using his usual channels.
Put up on the street, sent out to people, made it free download for my site. I wanted to create the poster earlier than I did, but I've been arrested 14 times for doing street art. And I didn't want to be perceived as a liability to the campaign, so I asked a friend who knew somebody in the campaign to ask, would it just be okay if I made a poster, not can we do an official collaboration or anything?
Fairey got the green light and turned out to be the opposite of a liability. His grassroots image, first seen at rallies and fundraisers, eventually became the universal image of Obama's campaign. Fairey says he made 300,000 posters and 500,000 stickers. The image even made it to the cover of Time magazine. And there was a Sea of Hope T-shirts at the inauguration. All of this propelled Fairey himself into the limelight.
Shepard certainly is a rock star these days.
That's Jill Medvedow, director of the ICA. She's giddy about her museum's timing, too. Curators here started planning the Shepard Fairey show about 18 months ago, she says, before the hope image even existed. Obama's election created a windfall of publicity for both the ICA and the artist.
But what is so important about the ICA exhibition is to take the work of this artist and look at it from the perspective of 20 years of making art, taking the work of an artist whose work has always been outside the museum and bringing it inside the museum.
If we have like a 12-foot Peace Lotus or Peace Bomber, yeah, something for the middle.
12-foot Peace Fingers?
Peace Fingers could be good.
Inside the museum's loading dock, Fairey directs his crew as they plot to plaster Boston with the artist's signature red and cream psychedelic images. And it's all legal, thanks to arrangements made by the museum. Small sections are heaped in piles on the cement floor. Scissors are used to trim the edges off the prints. Shepard calls the poster campaign bombing. This day's target is a wooden barricade in Boston's Chinatown.
What? No, I need one more. I need two.
The mural they're putting up of civil rights icon Angela Davis serves to advertise Fairey's show at the ICA, and it captures the spirit of Fairey's M.O., which he discovered as an art student in the 80s at the Rhode Island School of Design.
I was working at a skate shop making $4.25 an hour and supplementing my income by making homemade T-shirts of different punk bands that I liked, and I would make one for myself and two extra to sell to friends. And these were just hand-cut stencils.
He also made stickers to slap on skateboards and street signs. Some people say Ferry is the most recognized sticker artist on the planet. His very first iconic image was not a president, but a professional wrestler known as Andre the Giant.
One night a friend wanted to learn how to make a stencil, so I looked through the newspaper, saw a picture of Andre the Giant, and said, "Why don't you cut a stencil of this?" And he said, "No way, I'm not cutting that, that's stupid." And I said, "What are you talking about? Andre's posse is going to be the new posse that's taken over." You know, somehow this inside joke just turned into a big sticker campaign.
Ferry relentlessly stuck Andre the Giant's hulking mug everywhere. And even though plenty of people didn't know who Andre was, the image went viral in the underground among punks and alternakids. Ferry says it opened his eyes.
And I realized that images in public space have a provocative effect when they aren't easily decoded.
Here's one right on the corner. Boom.
Caleb Nealon is driving me around Boston, pointing out Ferry's legacy. He says he first started noticing the stickers as a teen skateboarding around the city in the late 80s.
The best way to look for them is just to start at any city in the U.S. and just to look for signs, street poles, or whatever, that happen to have those very, very famous little stickers of his. Either the original, the Andre the Giant has a posse sticker, or the Rorschach blotch-looking obey face. They'll be everywhere. And it's kind of one of those games that once you recognize this thing, you're going to see it forever. There's another one on another light pole as we pass the Mass Ave Bridge. There's another one on as we end the bridge. You'll keep seeing it again and again and again.
Nealon is a street artist himself and writes for graffiti magazines. He's long admired Ferry's determination to disseminate his body of work over the past 20 years. On the road between Andre the Giant and Barack Obama, there have been countless visual commentaries on rampant capitalism, consumerism, and the abuse of power. Ferry uses the language of advertising and propaganda to drive his messages home. In many ways, Ferry's hope image of Barack Obama should come as no surprise. But the artist says even the president marveled when they spoke in person.
He said, I love this image. Thank you very much for making it. And how did you get it spread around so fast?
The Smithsonian Museum already placed the hope image in the National Portrait Gallery in Washington, D.C.
With all the oil paintings of George Washington and every other president, yeah, that's pretty unbelievable. There were guards handling my piece with white gloves. I've never handled my own art with white gloves. It was very ironic.
Which isn't to say Ferry is new to galleries, because he isn't. His fine art pieces fetch thousands of dollars from collectors. He also designs logos for clients such as Honda and Dewar's Scotch. And now there's controversy about Ferry's uber-successful Obama image. The Associated Press says it's based on an AP photo, and they want credit and compensation. Ferry, a savvy entrepreneur, has long been criticized for selling out with his commercial work, but he says it supports the art making he's most passionate about.
Maybe some people could sit back and let their greatest hits catalog just continue to do the work. I'm not satisfied with that. And also, I have this fear of getting old, so doing the things I do makes me feel young.
He's not that old. Ferry turns 39 this month, but the punk artist says he'll embrace his Peter Pan complex by continuing his 20-year campaign of making mischief.
I never, never leave the house without stickers.
And he's still covered in poster glue and wearing a Clash t-shirt.
Police at the ease in the street.
Oh, yeah. Here now is Andrea Shea. To see photos and images from Shepard Ferry's exhibit at the ICA here in Boston, go to our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.